event to begin. So, with no further ado, may I please introduce Oscar Grammy Golden Globe winning Hall of Fame songwriter and ASCAP's new president and chairman of the board, Paul Williams.
Expectations, this is ASCAP. Good evening or good afternoon, everybody. Welcome. This is a great honor to introduce this gentleman. The word genius is casually thrown around a lot these days, but our special guest of honor this afternoon, there may be no better way to describe him. As a songwriter, producer, and leader of the Electric Light Orchestra, Jeff Lynne, please. Jeff Lynne pulled off an extraordinary feat by combining the energy of rock and roll, the grandeur of classical music, and a master craftsman's attention to detail. He elevated pop music to a higher level of sophistication while expanding its appeal to audiences across many genres. In songs such as Strange Magic, Living Thing, Evil Woman, Turn to Stone, Sweet Talkin' Woman, Telephone Line, Mr. Blue Sky, Hold On Tight, and many, many more, he forever changed what was possible in the studio, on the charts, and on stages around the world. ELO's music became a soundtrack for a generation, and through continued airplay on radio and frequent use in film, television, and in advertisements, hello, the Electric Light Orchestra has shone brightly in the lives of millions of fans for four decades. Lynne wrote and produced 20 top 40 hits in the U.S. with ELO to 20 top hits. Hello. To date, the group has sold in excess of 50 million records worldwide. An amazing comment. Jeff seldom rents a tuxedo, he owns several. Lynne. But ELO is not even half of Lynne's remarkable story. As a producer and a co-writer, he's collaborated with some of the greatest musical artists of all time, and he's added his magic touch to recordings by many of Lynne's personal heroes and dear friends. George Harrison, Paul McCartney, Ringo Starr, The Beatles, Roy Orbison, Tom Petty, Brian Wilson, my God, what a list, Del Shannon, and of course the beloved supergroup known as the Traveling Wilburys, made up of Lynne's... George Harrison, Roy Orbison, oh my God, Roy Orbison, Tom Petty, and Bob Dylan, this young upstart, Bob Dylan. He is at once a visionary pushing music beyond perceived boundaries and a steward of rock's roots, investing a lifetime love affair with lyrics and melody into recordings that will surely stand the test of time. Let's take a look at a video to enjoy some of Jeff's amazing work.
Oh,
inspiration to us all. He is our Golden Note Award recipient. He is the one and only Jeff Lynn. Jeff, come up. Let's sit down.
That it's an amazing pleasure, this thing. It really weighs its own as well, so it's worth the money. And so thank you absolutely very much, Asghar, and everybody concerned, and it's a great thrill for me. Thanks.
Congratulations, Jeff. Now to interview Jeff on his extraordinary career, I'd like to present the editor-in-chief of ASCAP's Playback magazine, Eric Philbrook. Eric, come up and...
Hello, Jeff. So did everyone have a chance to write down a question that we're going to ask at the end of the session here today? If not, make sure that if you have a question, get it to one of the ASCAP folks standing on the wings here, and we'll pick out some of the good questions. So, Jeff. Yeah, I think that's why I chose these chairs. So you came of age in Birmingham, England, during an extremely fertile period for rock and roll. Can you describe the environment you were in and the musical forces that were at play in your life at that time?
We're talking about like 1963, and Birmingham, England was like a wonderful place for music. It was all just groups on everywhere, in youth clubs, school halls, pubs, millions of pubs in Birmingham. That's where we got the havoc in there. And it's just a wonderful environment. Like, I saw millions of groups when I was a kid, and it was so inspiring that I had a favourite group at the time that was called Mike Sheridan and the Night Riders, who were my favourite group. They were wonderful. And I used to go and see them at this place called Chardin Community Centre, which was a little place where they were not very average player, probably, but it was really close to me and I loved it. Anyway, eventually, I saw in the paper one night, it said, this is probably 3 years later, it said, King lead guitarist wanted for Night Riders. And I went, shit, that's me. And I thought, I only think it's ever possible that I could actually do it. And I went to the audition, and I never found out for like about a week, and I was so worried about if I could pick up this job, because I'd be like 18 years old now and I was missing out on the big time already. And anyway, it turned out I got the job, and they really liked me, and I loved them, and they were my favourite group. So I got to join my favourite group in the first thing I ever did in proper music, professional music. So that was a great start for me. And we eventually changed our name to the Idle Rays, and that became quite popular in England. Obviously none of you have ever heard of it, but I've heard of it, and it was good, it was quite good. We made two albums, and so Birmingham, that hotbed of talent that was going on, was very important to me, and I learnt all of my stuff in those days.
So before you joined these groups, you obviously fell in love with the guitar. How did you get into playing the guitar?
Funny enough, I was at a friend's house one afternoon, and I was going through his cupboards, you know, as you do. And, and in one cupboard, I just could not believe my eyes. It was an Elvis Presley plastic guitar. And I picked it up, and I just went, wow, I've never even seen a guitar before. Like, in somebody's house, you know. Groups had them, but I'd never seen anybody actually owning one, even a plastic one. So I said, can I borrow it? And I went home, and I kind of learned every tune in the world on one string. It had one little nylon string on it. It was about this long. And I learned every song there was, but you have to start in very funny places up the fretboard on one string, because there's this one lower note that's going to catch your eye if you don't do it, and you can't play that because you're only using one string and there's only one string on there. So anyway, I did that, and it went a bit like this. This is the first song I ever learned, a tune I ever learned, and it was very silly, and it went... It's only one finger. Oh, sorry. That's it. Well, that was my first musical experience. And, after the couple of orgasms, I sort of put it to bed for a while. And that was how I got started. And then my dad brought me home one day. It was a big surprise, a shock, in fact. A big old brown Spanish guitar with six strings on it. I went, oh, what the hell did you do with all them other ones? I know all about that one, but what about all these two? And anyway, I got the book, you know, of chords, like you do, and tuned it wrong for about the first 2 weeks. I thought, you useless bastard. Like, everything I played was like sounding crap, because one of the strings was tuned to the wrong note. And somebody had told me that, and I never even checked it in the book. Eventually, I checked it, found that I could play a chord, and I went, oh, good, I am brilliant, after all. So it was scary at first, but I got over it.
So when did you decide to seriously pursue music as a possible career or as a livelihood?
Well, as soon as I'd learnt the Third Man theme. It didn't take me long to realise that I was going to be good at this kind of thing. Now, I did have an inbuilt thing. When I joined the group, the Night Riders, and we started playing at better and better places I was in them for 4 years, from 1966 till 1970, and we gradually rose to great kind of university gigs, you know, which were really good, alongside Pink Floyd and all those people, not all those people, but Bonzo, Doug, Doo-Dah Band. We played those sort of prestigious kind of gigs, and I was very chuffed with that. And eventually I joined, I didn't really want to leave the Idlewise because I loved the guys, and it was a very nice group, you know. It wasn't sort of squabbling or any crap. It was a very pleasant situation. And anyway, I joined the Move after 4 years. I thought, I've got to, you know, how much time can you give it, you know, to make it? And so I joined the Move, and because of the Move, we were making hit singles in the Move, and that paid for the ELO album, the first one, and that's how that came about.
So at what point did you fall in love with the recording process? Because that's obviously a big part of what you got into. Were you able to start experimenting and exercising your own ideas at an early stage, or did you build your own studio?
Well, what I did, I was desperate to make recordings in my house, you know, in Mum and Dad's house, and they had a front room which was spare. Nobody ever used it. You know, it was one of those hush rooms that was all smart. Nobody ever went in there because it was too smart. Anyway, so I soon wrecked that. And I had all this junk in there. And I got this thing called the Bang & Olufsen 2000 Deluxe, which was a tape recorder that you could bounce from one track to another, from like left to right, add a guitar as you go, back to the left, add another guitar or a piano, because I'd taught myself piano already by then. Anyway, but yeah, roughly, still pretty rough actually, but so I could make records in the front room of my house, and I had the drums were a piano stool and a drumstick, and I actually learned how to make recordings like that. They actually sounded like records, even though they're only demos. And so I learned basically all the stuff I know from that one little tape recorder, which I've still got, and it still works, which is amazing.
That's great. So what was the concept for ELO? How did that originate?
The The concept was, when I was in the Isle of Wight, I first used some strings, like an orchestra, on a track on an Isle of Wight album. I think it was a song called Going Home, and it was a proper orchestra, like probably 16-piece string section. And I was so amazed by it, I was just taken aback, and I got them to give me just a string track so I could listen to it and study it, you know. And I don't actually read music at all, so it all looks like, what? You know, I don't understand it. I still don't. I've tried, and I look and they say, this is the timing, that big white lump is like a long one. It's a real quick one, so don't worry about it, just do what it says. And I've no idea what it says, about learning algebra or something. You know, I just think I'm going to bother with that. And so I just carried on doing it by ear, and it served me really well, luckily.
So the group seemed to strike an initial chord in America. Why do you think that you had such an impact in America, whereas England didn't seem to get hip to you guys so soon?
Not right away here in England. I think mainly we did well in America first because we sort of concentrated on coming to America and doing tours. I think one of the first ones was like the Santa Monica Civic and a few smaller places like that. And that was in like 73. And then we started going on other tours supporting famous groups at the time. And that sort of got a name around, and then the records started to climb into the low end of the charts. And so it was quite an amazing feeling to be in the charts and playing big venues, which we couldn't do in England yet. You know, we could still only fill like a 1,000 seats in England or something like that.
Right. So as a songwriter, composer, and producer of ELL, you wore many hats. Did you enjoy that, or was it almost necessary to take on all those roles to make it work?
Well, all those hats, you see, that was my favourite thing about music, was doing everything. I loved writing the songs. I loved working out the arrangements of them, all the guitar bits and the piano parts and stuff, even if it wasn't playing the strings. But the string parts came, all we had in the group at that point was two cellos and a violin, as well as electric piano, mellotron. Drums, bass, and guitar, that was it. It wasn't really an orchestra, so it was more like a combo, you know, if you like. But it was called an orchestra, so people thought, oh, it's an orchestra. Which is great. Until they have to sound like something really big, which I couldn't do. So on the fourth album, which is called El Dorado, I actually got, oh! Got a giant orchestra in there, like a 40-piece section and a choir. I thought, you know, let's really go to town on this. And I'd written all the songs, and I wanted it to be a continuous piece, you know, it was like a theme, if you like, which was a kind of a thing they had in those days. Like, oh, it's a concept album, man. And it didn't have to make me go to sleep immediately if you say that word, but. And at the time, just before I made the album, I'd been talking with my dad, and he said, you know, the trouble with your tunes, he said, they got no tune. Thanks, Dad. Right. So I thought, what do I do now? Well, I'll show the bugger. I wrote all these melodic tunes on El Dorado, and totally away from what I'd been doing, which was supposedly kind of avant-garde, or as George used to say, avant-garde clue. So that was the way it went, and I did all melodic stuff, and I wasn't ashamed, and said, right, that's it, it's all tunes. Played it for my dad, and said, oh, you made this for me, haven't you? And I went, yes. And he went, thanks, son, it's great.
Well,
that was sweet. And I finally had some feedback from my dad.
So, I want to ask you about the ELL spaceship, because it really is one of the most iconic images in rock history, and as a branding device, it's ingenious. How did the whole spaceship concept motif make its way into the mix, and tell us a little bit about the physical spaceship that you actually took on tour with you?
Well, the physical spaceship actually took us on tour with it. We could do like a 3-month tour in 10 days. What it was a very cumbersome, it looked like a giant fiberglass hamburger on a drum song, I think. It just looked like there was no lights on it. It looked pretty grim, but when they lit it up, the sound effects, like the roaring of the engines and all that stuff, it looked marvellous. And I used to just jump off the stage at the end of every show just to have a look at it closing and watch the people's faces, because it was actually a stunning sight, you know, and a racket. The PA was blowing its guts out for reproducing these really low engine noises, mm-hmm. and rocket noises, whatever. And it was a great thing, even though it was uncomfortable to play in, because sometimes, you know, the echo inside the shell of this big fiberglass hull was like really fast, and it was putting you off. It was like maybe a few milliseconds late. Everything with a slight delay on it, which was annoying, but you got used to it. And it was such a big thing that we used to have to do a thing called an A show and a B show, where the A show was with the flying saucer, and it took so long to dismantle and load it up onto like 10 semis, or wherever it was there to put them off. And they would have to go to the next but one show and set it up there, because they didn't have time to do it every night. And so it was a very strange, this was out on the Out of the Blue tour in 78, when we had that spaceship. And it really was a cumbersome, and it was probably the biggest thing that ever went on the road at that point in time in musically.
Right. Who came up with the idea for the spaceship? Was it something that came out of a song or
What happened was, the logo had gradually been taught to fly, and it was now on an album called A New World Record. The logo sat above a skyline, which I thought of, and it was almost looking like a spaceship. And then when the art department went to work on the Out of the Blue album, they turned the logo actually into a spaceship once and for all. There was a little spaceship early on a very early album that was more like an air raid shelter with a little lighthouse on it. But I don't know, that never caught on, that one. But and anyway, we got the proper one, and it was the art department of United Artists.
It worked out well for you.
Yeah, it did work out great.
So many of your ELO hits, such as Living Thing, Mr. Blue Sky, Telephone Line, Turn to Stone, are immaculately crafted works of studio production. But yet they are works of genius as pure songwriting too. When you were writing songs for ELO, were you able to write just as a songwriter? Were you able to set out those other roles and other voices in your head to just focus on the song?
Those voices, yeah. No, that's the trouble. That's why I'm daft as a brush, actually. Because I used to listen to myself too much, and I would, because I was the producer, the songwriter, the singer, the arranger, and I did used to play lead guitar as well. So I had a lot of things to think about, but I wouldn't have had it any other way. I wanted total control over over my work, because when I first did music at a recording contract, the Liberty Record people, that's when the Idleways got our first deal, said, well, you'll need a producer now. I said, no, I'm a producer. And I didn't have a clue, really, except for my little £100 tape recorder, which used to be out of bands left and right. I didn't tell them that was my experience, but I'd go with some demos, and they went, these are fantastic. And I went, really? They said, come down and have dinner with us in London. London, I went, you're joking. Come and meet Harvey at the motorway. I said, certainly, I'll be down there immediately. And I did, and we had a nice talk, and they gave me a fans. I couldn't believe I was actually getting money. And the one person who couldn't believe all this money I was getting was my mum. She'd go, because we used to get like paid the same as my dad, probably. I thought I'd be earning the same as my dad, and I was only like 19 years old at this point. And I had this drawer full of money. And every time I wanted to make a bedroom, and I was certain Mum would do that. And she said, what the hell's all that money doing in there? Where do you get it from? And I said, I've earned it from doing music. She said, come on, where'd you get it from, really? She obviously wasn't a fan.
So, who were some of the classical composers that influenced the orchestral side of your music?
I think at that point, mainly Tchaikovsky. And a little bit of...
You got a Tchaikovsky fan in there?
And he was great. And I liked him a lot. And I based that El Dorado intro kind of on his full symphony. Mm-hmm. Sort of mixed it back, really, because he wasn't around to play it.
So towards the end of the 70s, as disco music became very popular, you integrated some disco rhythms and sounds into the music on your album Discovery with Shine a Little Love and Last Train to London. What was it about that music that interested you?
What it was about that music was the simplicity and the straightforward four to the bar. It gave me so much space to just have fun and not even worry about the drum part, you know? Just have fun with bang, bang, bang. There's so much you can fit in between those bangs. Lots of stuff, but still keep it simple. And the album was actually called Disco Very. Discovery. So.
So your catalog of ELO songs is such an incredible body of work. Are there any songs that are your own personal favorites, either for what you were able to express in a lyric or what you were able to achieve in the studio during that era?
I do have some favorites, and usually because they're usually the ones that come the quickest to you, you know. And like one of my favorites is Mr. Blue Sky, which. Thank you. That was like, I felt like that was a proper song. It was well rounded and it was that kind of thing where you could actually feel good about it. Mm-hmm. An early one of mine that I liked also was Can't Get It Out of My Head. Thank you. And that was a lot of fun because that was all the big strings, the big first time using the big orchestra and some harmonies and. Yeah, what I love doing basically is harmonies and layering stuff on top of each other. It's all based on that funny little tape recorder in the B&O 2000 Deluxe.
So your music continues to be used in film and on television and advertisements. And music placement today is so important, not just as a source of revenue, but getting your music heard by a wider audience. As you know, there are opportunities and risks involved in this. What lessons have you learned, or what is your guiding principle in allowing your music to be used in such a way?
Well, basically, it's how much they're going to pay. No, that's not correct. I have a very big principle on this because I don't like to use it for advertising if it's something I don't believe in personally or I'm against. Anything that's got like hamburgers in it or anything like that, you know, or just weird stuff, I don't like that. And if it's in films, I like to see the premise of the film, and they always show me, and in some cases they actually show me the film. There was one instance when Boogie Nights, when they that scene at the end, when he's got his giant willy out, and it looks as though my music is coming out the end of his car. And it's like down here somewhere, and I go. And so I had to go and see, because I've got two young girls, they were very young at the time, and I was embarrassed for them in case they thought, you dirty old sod, what are you doing playing porno stuff, you know, with your music? And I was embarrassed for them. So I went to see it, and it wasn't bad at all. It was actually a wonderful film, and I loved it. And I just said, oh, please have the song. Don't take it out now, whatever you do. I mean, don't pull it out now, sorry.
So in the early 80s, you began to focus on writing and producing for other artists, most of whom could be described as roots rockers, such as Dave Edmunds, Duane Eddy, and the Everly Brothers. Was it a conscious decision to shift from working with the grandiosity of ELO to music that didn't have so many pieces?
Well, actually, it was that kind of thing. I got sort of fed up with, by then I'd done like so many big orchestral sessions that it was beginning to get a bit, you know, oh, not them again. And there's undertone, you know, well, there's 40 of them and maybe 20 choir. And it was sort of nice just to do some simple things. I'd been starting to simplify my ELO record at that point as well, just using guitar, piano, and drums, and bass, and lots of harmonies. So it was time to have a go at some other people.
So what was it? What were you most interested in pursuing at this stage? After pretty much doing so much for so long, what was it that you really looked out for?
A break first, that was a nice thing, to have a nice long break, and then suddenly one of the people I was working with, Dave Edmunds, we had dinner one night in this big posh restaurant in on the Thames somewhere, and we had this big slap-up dinner, got drunk as rat bags, and we started walking our separate ways outside this place as we went to our taxis or whatever we were going. And he's about like 100 yards up the street. He says, "By the way, yeah, I forgot to mention, while we've just been sitting having a 3-hour dinner, I forgot to mention, George Harrison asked me to ask you if you'd like to work on him, work with him on his new album." So I said, "By the way, what do you mean by, what did you tell me that like 3 hours ago?" And I couldn't believe it, but he'd left it that long. Anyway, I eventually went to George's house, and it was such a frightening experience, the first time of going to George's house, and just going up the drive, I said, "I can't do it. I'm going," actually Dave Edmunds took me up there for the first time, but I needn't have worried, because once I got there, Liv was there, and she said, "Oh, George is down by the lake," and so I walked down to the lake, and there was George, and he shook hands, and he said, "Hey, Jeff, it's great to meet you," and I said, "It's great to meet you." So we're going on this little boat ride down, and he's got these wonderful lakes to go on, and they've got sort of underground tunnels in them, which is amazing. It's very complicated to explain, but he said, "Now what you do, don't hold the sides of the boat with your hands, just grip with your bum." So I thought, he's my kind of guy. So it was so funny immediately, just put your ease right away. It was, and that, we were great friends from then until 15 years.
So when you first began collaborating with him, was it daunting to work with one of your heroes?
Oh, absolutely. It was really hard at first. You know, I was very shy around George, and he used to say, "Don't be so shy." And I said, I'm a bit in awe of you, mate, still. And he said, "In awe of me? No, you're kidding." He was so disarming, you know, charming and lovely guy, George. And eventually, yeah, it took a couple of months before I could sort of think, "Oh, he's my mate now," and relax, yeah, completely. And I did, and we got on great, and we had wonderful times, and made some great records, I hope.
So, that's great. So, did you and George have similar approaches to writing a song, or did you have different approaches that worked well together? How did that work?
We kind of worked very much in a similar way. You start off with some chords, nice chords, like you do, you know, you go, "Oh, that's a nice one," and then this is a change right there. And George loved diminished chords, which he used to call the naughty chord. Because not many people, not all players use the diminished, not a lot of them, and in fact a lot of them don't. So the diminished and the augmented are both naughty chords, because they're neither quite one thing or the other. And they're wonderful though. In the case of, for instance, Richard Rodgers, he really knows where to stick one. He does, mate. That's the right song, like he does.
Well, So with George, you had the great fortune of working in one of the coolest supergroups in rock history, the Traveling Wilburys. It almost seems impossible that this could ever happen, but how did all of these great artists come together?
It does seem that way. The only way that could have ever happened was because of George, and because we'd become great pals, and while we're making his album Cloud Nine, he said, you know, he used to say at night, we used to have great nights, like where we'd finish work, have dinner, and then we'd hang in the studio and listen back to what we'd worked on, see what we could change for tomorrow or what we could work out for tomorrow. And then start, you know, have a good drink and have a good laugh, you know. And this same topic has come up every night. We should have a group, you know, George would say to me. I'd say, yeah, fantastic, let's have one. It wouldn't be like that. And he'd say, you know, it wouldn't be like this. You know, Ned Trilby in it, and you know, Arthur Wellgrove or anybody. Let's have,
are those real people?
No. Like, let's have Bob Dylan. I want Bob Dylan. I said, well, can I have Roy Orbison in it then? Yeah. Are we talking real things here? And they're like, what the hell are we talking about? And I just got to know Tom. I met him backstage at a Bob Dylan tour when Tom and the Heartbreakers were being his backing group for a whole tour. And Tom was really friendly, and so what we, I forgot the question.
how did actually all come together?
So we both, I wanted Roy, and George wanted Bob, and we both wanted Tom, because we both met Tom and really liked him. I'd worked with him on a couple of tracks already, on Full Moon Fever, and we've done probably two or three songs, thank you. And it turned out that we both got Tom as well, so George just made the phone calls. Do you want to be in our group to Bob? And he said, yeah, sure, okay. And we went down to, we asked Roy, and he said, well, we should talk about this. And we went down to see a show of Roy's. He was playing in a theatre in Irvine, I think it was, and we sat up there early, watched the whole show, did all just like the ladies there, going, wah! Every time he hit those high notes, and, you know, screaming for him, because he's so fantastic, you just couldn't believe it, you know. And so at the end of the show, we're all like, oh, you know, this is marvellous, you know, he really was. And we went backstage into his dressing room, and George came right out, he said, hey, George, and he said, hey, Roy, do you want to be in our group? And Roy said, sure, okay, I'll be in it. What's it called? Well, it's called the Travelling Wilburys. Oh, the Travelling Wilburys. Nobody could understand why it's called the Travelling Wilburys. And the reason it was because me and George had been thinking of a name for like 6 months while we were making George's album, of what this group would be. And it went through many, many changes, and ended up as the Travelling Wilburys. So you can imagine what it went through to get there.
So there's a true spirit of camaraderie that shines through the Travelling Wilburys' work. Would you explain how you recorded with the group and how it affected the way you record now?
Yeah, it was a very interesting way to record, because we used houses to make those albums, and used different rooms in those houses, which was unusual at the time. Now it's quite commonplace, I believe, because everybody's got a studio in their house now. But this was a house that was a studio. It's like my house now. My house is a studio, and I did mine like that because of the way we did the Wilburys. It's so nice to have any different room wired up so you can just be making any sound you want. You know, your sounds are always different in any room you go in, and you can make wonderful effects on things just by the acoustics of a room. And I prefer using that than any kind of digital reverb or anything like that. The main great sounds come from actual microphones in rooms with no stuff added to it electronically. That's what I find. And that's how we always do it.
Find that that's
after that experience, you can continue in that spirit of recording like that?
We made both of Wilbur's albums in that way. The last house we used was an amazing place. It was called Wilbury Mansion. Well, we called it that, but we had our own flag. The Wilbur's flag was flying on the top of this hill. And it was like a giant mansion from like the 20s. And we used all these big rooms, libraries, and all sorts of things. It was a wonderful place to record. But we always went back to George's to mix the record and put the finishing touches on it.
Right. And around the same time, you also had the privilege of working on Roy Orbison's last album, for which must have been a great, great honor for you. How did your relationship with Roy start?
My manager Craig said, I said to him, oh, I'd love to meet Roy Orbison one day. And he said, oh, I know him. Do you want me to get his phone number? So he did. I called up Roy. He knew about me somehow, and he said, hey, why don't you come down and we'll write some songs together? I went, who, me? Didn't he? And he said, sure, come on down. So I went down to Nashville, and I spent like probably a week there. We wrote some songs together. We never finished any of them, but we sort of half wrote about three songs, and never finished. And anyway, it was time to go home then, so I came back to LA, and I never heard another word from him for about a year. And the phone rang, and it was Roy, and he said, hey Jeff, I'm in Malibu, and I'm ready to work. I went, wow, fantastic. And he said, let's get writing. And he came over to my house, and we wrote You Got It. Such a thrill to do that with him, and just to work with Roy and get him, have him have a hit that was as big as some of his biggest ones he'd ever had, you know, all those years ago. It was such a thrill, and he was so happy. He was happy. I've never seen him so happy. Well, I wouldn't have done. But anyway, we did another couple of songs on the album, three songs altogether on the Mystery Girl album, and Roy was such a sweetheart, and in the Wilburys, he sort of, we got to be really close pals because of making those songs on that album, but I'll never forget some of the Wilbury sessions. He would come up in his car and he'd call me over secretly and he'd go, Jeffy, he'd call me. And I'd go, he said, look at this. He'd open his trunk and there'd be five fabulous cakes, like, or, you know, whatever you call them over here. Either cream cakes or wonderful, you know, big dollops of cake. And he'd say, which one do you want before anybody else gets here? And I was like, hi, I was so honoured, you know. Ah, oh, thanks, Roy, he's such a sweetheart. You'd be the first choice, thank you. So that was good. And so I loved Roy's bits, and then the most unfortunate thing ever was when he just passed away without, you know, even doing anything else again. But what I sometimes think, what a tragedy he had to die, because we could have done so many songs together, written them together, which would be like, You Got It. And we could have gone on forever, because me and him got a really good thing going. You know, we understood each other's music really well. And it was so sad, but then I have to think, at least I had a year with him that was fantastic, and we were doing like, he was in the top five. We had the Wilburys in the top five, and it was a wonderful time for him. So it's like George used to say, that was a day's a lucky one.
So with Tom Petty, who you also began working with around this time, you created some of the best albums of his career. What is it about Tom's music and his approach to making music that allowed you to connect so well with Tom?
You know, it's very strange, but we got on musically right away from the start. You know, I was actually at a light in Beverly Hills, a traffic light, and I hear this horn honking away at me and going, Jeff, Jeff. So I'm almost scared to look at it. So I look, and I thought it was some nutty. No, but it wasn't. It was Tom. And I went, hey, Tom. And he said, pull over, I want a word with you. So we pulled over to the side on, I think it was like Cannon Drive. And he said, hey, I've just been, we've got a barbecue going at the moment. And we're playing George's album. He said, we're loving it, it's fantastic. So, do you fancy writing some songs with me? And I said, I'd love to. That would be fantastic. I'd love that. He said, come to the barbecue. So I went to the barbecue, and there was George's album playing. I thought, yeah, he's good, isn't he? Yeah. But I had it on that night. Oh, there you go.
Thanks. We'll get to, these are some questions from the audience, which we'll get to. I have a few more questions for you. In 1995, you were given the honor of working with the three surviving Beatles on the anthology series and making John Lennon's demos of Free as a Bird and Real Love into two new Beatles tracks. In a career of many highlights, this must have been one of the highest. The finished tracks are beautiful. How much of a challenge was it to accomplish the end result, and what did it mean to you to work on that project?
It was the scariest thing ever, and also the most exciting. So it would be like every morning, George and myself were living in a little house by George's, by Paul's studio, which was where we were recording it. And there wasn't actually anything to record. There was this little cassette with his voice and piano, John's voice and piano, stuck together on one track, even a mono cassette. So it's almost impossible to do anything with. So I loved it, you know. Oh, I grew up and really do something with it, you know, like invent something, you got to do that. And but every morning, George would be up first and he'd go, come on, you lazy bastard. And I'd be always in bed going, oh my God, how am I going to do that bit there? You know, I'm still thinking about what was flying ahead the next day. I didn't know Paul very well at the time. And so Paul was a little bit strange. And we've since now great pals, very great friends with Paul and Ringo. And, but it was hard a little bit because I came in as George's pal. So they were a little bit wary of me. But we soon got to be great pals. And what I had to do in the end was actually get an average tempo of the track, say Free as a Bird, which is just this little rough demo with all the hiss and rumble and everything you can imagine on it. Virtually, you'd say, well, you can't even start with that, and we couldn't. So we had to do a backing track of an average speed of that. I mean, this would have been easy now. But then we didn't have computers. Paul didn't have any computers in his studio at the time, and they weren't common like they are now. So anyway, what I had to do was we laid down the Beatles track, we finished the Beatles backing track, and it sounded fantastic, sounded just like the Beatles. And then sneakily one night I stayed behind and flew Johnny with my finger to Johnny, like free as a bird. Okay, got that phrasing. Just off a Pooh song, which is a little sampler, an early sampler, low bandwidth, kind of. Anyway, Paul heard a bit of the work I'd done, and at the end of the session, he came and gave me this great big hug and just said, well done, mate, you did it. And that was the biggest accolade I could get for him. And it was a marvellous feeling to have actually accomplished it. But, and then we had to do another one. So it wasn't exactly a... It was very, very hard, and it was probably the hardest thing I would ever have to think about or do.
Well, you helped give the world two new Beatles tracks, so we thank you for that. So I understand that you've done some production work on the forthcoming album by Regina Spektor. Do you want to talk about that and just tell us what, you know, after working with so many great artists, what drives you today?
Yeah, well, I was given a couple of CDs of Regina's, and I didn't know much about her at all, but I listened to the work, and I thought, wow, this girl's, like, really, really clever, and the tunes were lovely, her voice was great, the arrangements were really cool. I just thought she was, like, really modern and up there, and a really big talent, and that's why I got involved. I did five tracks I produced at my studio, and it was great fun. She was just as highly talented and as picky as I would imagine. And mm-hmm. So, you know, she gave me a run around a bit. So it made me work, so that's good. Stretch me a bit, you know.
So I understand you're also doing work with the great Joe Walsh. What can we expect from
We've been having some fun, Joe and myself, and we like to have a strum together now and again. And I think we're going to, eventually, I think we're going to make a do a collaboration where we make an album together.
All right. So we do have some questions from the audience. Hopefully, I'll be able to read some of the handwriting here. Since 1987, you have departed radically from your futuristic synth-pop sound towards a more acoustic sound. Since then, many up-and-coming artists have copied your 80s style, for example, the Flaming Lips. Any chance we'll hear Jeff's sound in the future again? For example, a middle ground between the 80s ELO and the Wilbury sound?
I kind of think that's what I do anyway. I have a certain sound, like you say. My production, sort of, there are certain parameters that I like to be within. I don't like reverb. That's the odd thing that I think is different about my sound, is that I don't put any reverb on things. And the reason is I just like the sound of real rooms, and that's why I do it that way. Will it sound like ELO or the Wilburys? I don't suppose it will, but it will sound like me. Mm-hmm. That will always happen, because it's the idea.
So here's one. Have you seen the Broadway version of Xanadu? And what do you think of the cult following for Xanadu? I love Xanadu, so I'm right at the end here.
I think it's very... I'm amazed that they did a play of it, really, but I've never seen the film, but I don't know much about it. I just did half the music for the film, and I just sort of did it, and that was over with it. But now it still keeps going, and now they're talking about doing a film of the play of the film. So good luck to him.
here's one from Brian Matthew. He asked, tell us about Mr. Blue Sky's songwriting process recording. The funky synth with the voice is so great on so many levels. Tell us everything.
I'll tell you everything, okay? The vocoder, which is what makes the piano talk, is a very old thing from when I was a little lad. I remember it for the first time when I was probably about 5 years old. It was on a thing called Sparky's Magic Piano. I don't know if anybody here ever heard it. And it was a single that they used to play on the children's radio program called Children's Favorites. And it was invariably on every week. And that piano sound used to haunt me. It was like a piano with asthma. It really was. Wonderful, I loved it. I could picture this thing heaving its way through the chords and really straining to get it out. And while I was making Out of the Blue in Munich, in Germany, up the road in Stuttgart, I just made a new prototype of the vocoder, which I just heard of. The engineer just told me that day, wow, they've just got one finished, we can go and pick it up. So we sent our girlfriend to go and pick it up. They brought it back. There was no manual because it was a prototype, so we had to work it out. It took about a day just to get a sound out of it. But the sound we got was Mr. Blue Sky, you know, the way the piano sings in that song. And I was so thrilled, and I was thinking, like, wow, I've got a Sparky's Magic Piano on my record. So I was chuffed to bits about that, and that's how that happened anyway. And that's the funky sound you're talking about. Sparky's Magic Piano.
So here's another one. What would have been the biggest difference if you had the technology that exists today when you were working on the ELO stuff?
I would have probably finished it in about 2 weeks. Yeah, that's the only thing. everything's so easy. Everything's facilitated, you know, about facilities now, rather than the actual sound. How does it sound? Not how does it sound? How quick can you do it? And it's a bit of a shame in a way. I still try and put things through analog before they go onto digital, just to get them softened up a little bit, you know, and take the brittleness out of them a bit. And so I think I probably wouldn't have done what I did in those days. In those days, if you wanted a certain weird sound, you had to make it yourself, like a gaffer tape string and elastic and all sorts of crap, you know, to make a weird sound, and a tin pot. Whatever, but you get them all built in there. You go, tin pot, elastic, gaffer tape. Set up with all them. So you don't do it anymore, you know, you just have to make your own sounds with real pianos and you just pay up.
This one asks, how do you feel about the advent of MIDI, as in for string arrangements?
It's good. The samples are definitely getting better. You know, all these string samples, they're much better than they used to be. They used to sound so horrible, you know, and narrow and hard and nasty. But they sound actually quite great now, some of them. Some of the really good string libraries you get, and the choir libraries, I've just got a new one of those. They sound wonderful. So it is getting better all the time.
And do you keep up on new developments in technology as much as
I keep up with them, yeah, because I get them as soon as I hear about them. The new thing was supposed to be the greatest thing since sliced bread, I get it. Just to have a check it out.
This one asks, what inspired Symphony for a Rainy Day?
Probably living in England. And in actual fact, you know, it does rain a lot there, but it's beautiful. Don't get me wrong, it's wonderful green countryside and, England's green and pleasant planet. But it gets up your wick after a bit, you know, and you start to go, oh, wish it was sunny more. And so I came over here, and this was like, wow, it's like paradise, really, because it's always sunny. So your mood is always a little bit better than it would be with a grey, low sky, mm-hmm. with this big blue open sky. Just give you, and that's how I wrote Mr. Blue Sky. I was looking out of the window in Switzerland where I was writing Out of the Blue, and for like 2 weeks it was overcast and drizzling, and one day it was just like all opened up, the sky was blue, the sun was shining, and I actually wouldn't call anything to do. I wrote a song called Mr. Blue Sky.
So this one asks, what suggestions do you have for today's generation of aspiring writers, producers, and performers? Did that say something succinctly that could...
pack it up. No, not really, not pack it up. Just, you've got to love it so much, you've really got to put everything into it, you know, like every single ounce of energy into it. And if you don't do that, then you'll never... ever get what you want. You've got to put in what you get out, you know. You've got to put it in to get it out. If you don't, that's why it sounds like a maniac, but you've got to want it to be producer, songwriter, singer. Because I had a vision that I wanted to do, and I knew exactly how to do it. Well, I thought I did. It took me a while, but I got it eventually. And I think if you don't have that belief or that will to do it, if you think like, well, I'd rather go to the pub right now, then you're not going to do it. You've got to stick at it. Go down the pub years later. Cool. When you finish it.
All right. This one comes from Mr. Joe Walsh.
Trouble.
He says, it was great to see you last night. Where is my car? So
nice, Joe.
Anyway, that's all the time we have with Jeff today.
Thank you for your support. Thank you.
Thank you.